Hello and welcome to the World Soccer Talk podcast, your weekly dose of talking about watching soccer on TV, online and apps. Coming up on episode 41, we discuss the future of soccer and what it looks like on streaming in the United States. Lots of revealing soccer TV ratings from last weekend, news about more soccer coverage coming to ESPN3, and promising news at last about NBC's Premier League Pass. My name is Christopher Harris, aka The Gaffer, and I'm joined today by Kartik Krishnaiyer on Transfer Deadline Day. We're recording this on Thursday, and several hours before the window closes. But for Kartik, it's one of those fascinating days in some ways because we don't have Sky Sports News in the United States. NBC will have their broadcast from 5 p.m. Eastern on Thursday. But most of the activity seems to be on Twitter. What's your thoughts in terms of kind of how the deadline day experience has changed for good or bad?
Well, I think it's just it's a Twitter thing, it's been a Twitter thing since 2010 or 2011, 2010 maybe when we first had the deadline day hashtag. It's if you want to aggregate information, track information, Twitter is the place to do it. And I think what we're finding more and more now is that even Sky Sports, if you have Sky Sports News in the UK, okay, you're watching that. But even Sky Sports, they're going to Twitter first. Mm-hmm. And they're posting updates on Twitter or linking to updates and to their live blogs. So you'll even have The Guardian has an active live blog. The Mirror has an active live blog, Sky Sports News, etc. They are tweeting out the same updates you're putting on that live blog. So you've even seen kind of this evolution from television and live blogging to Twitter being the repository for everything, and then you can jump from Twitter to wherever. So if you have Twitter, you're set with deadline day. As always, I mean, by the time people listen to this, this will be dated probably. But as always, you're hearing 100 different stories. 70 or 80 of them won't happen.
Yeah, I've been watching Sky Sports News today just to have it on in the background, just in terms of just kind of seeing how they're covering the transfer deadline day. And for those viewers that are not able to watch the show, or you mean from the US, you're not missing much, to be honest with you. As one example, in one of the news segments, they had a whole news segment on the fact that Alexis Sanchez pressed like on a tweet. And that was a whole new segment where they were like, oh, what does this mean? Does this mean that he's staying? Does this mean he's leaving? And so much of the news, I mean, anyone that's really on Twitter or on Reddit or any of the news sources, you'll see that sometimes minutes, sometimes it could be half an hour ahead, that that those people are actually the ones that are breaking the news. And then Sky Sports News, according to their sources, which is not really their sources, it's the sources that they're using are, you know, Twitter and people like Damasio and Guillaume Balague, and sources, actually real sources out in the field. Those are the ones that are breaking the stories. And then Sky Sports are saying Sky Sports News source, which is not really.
Yeah. So. And ESPN got in trouble for this in the U.S. for years, where ESPN would say ESPN sources say such and such. Let's say it's a college football coach is taking the Texas A&M job. And then eventually there was so much pushback in the U.S. market that ESPN had to say ESPN sources confirm a story first reported by the Sporting News, right, or by whoever, mm-hmm. By FoxSports.com. I think Sky will get into that trouble pretty quickly.
Yeah,
they will probably get some pushback soon and will be forced to make that adjustment.
Yeah, Transfer Deadline Day has become a Sky event. It's become a show. And most of it, if you watch it for several hours, there's no major news being reported other than maybe one transfer here, one there. So they just drag it out. And as the Transfer Deadline Day gets down to the last few hours and the suspense builds, it's kind of funny in some ways to watch it, but it's one of those things that I don't think most of us in the U.S. would we're not missing much. That's the kind of the bolts and nuts of it. It's just that it's overrated, it's drama, it's suspenseful, but it's television, and that's what television's all about. So speaking of television, Kartik, I know this past week, especially from this past weekend, you've been kind of busy focusing on the weather side in terms of the flooding and the hurricanes. And that's one of your passions outside of soccer. But other than the weather, what types of games and matches and programming have you been watching this past week?
Yeah, the weather Friday night and the hurricane making a direct landfall in Texas prevented me from watching the New York Derby. So I was planning on watching that Red Bull versus NYCFC game. Did not see it. Some people tell me it was an entertaining match. We'll talk more about that later. So I missed that game because of the weather. So this weekend, ended up watching Bournemouth-Manchester City first thing in the morning Saturday. John Champion, David Pleat were in excellent form. It was obviously an entertaining game and a lot of talking points coming from the game about Raheem Sterling's red card and Mike Dean in general. So that that filled up a lot of time.
I was like amazed by John Champion and David Pleat, how well they did in that last 10 minutes of the game, because it was so crazy. There were so many fouls happening off the ball. There were the players going down everywhere. Then there was, of course, the goal celebration. And just, again, a lot of the off-the-camera incidents, and this is something that John Champion is one of the best at, is letting the viewer know, even if the camera's not focused on some unsavory incidents. He's a great person at actually painting a picture, telling you exactly what's going on. And sometimes the TV cameras don't want to focus on that on purpose because they don't want to encourage fans to invade the pitch or to, you know, kind of to swallow up players whole into a crowd. But I thought both that John Champion and David Pleat did a great job in this feverish ending to the game.
Yeah, it was really a crazy ending there at the Vitality Stadium. Then switched to Bremen and Bayern, which had just kicked off. Warren Barton was the co-commentator for this match, and was Ross Dyer was the commentator. But Barton's commentary was just very predictable. It was largely useless. He made some decent points, but to the same points any commentator would make. It was interesting to hear him as a co-commentator for this match and not in the studio. I think Fox is just trying to find a role for him. And see what they do with him as we approach the World Cup.
Yeah, especially with him not being involved in the studio setup for the Bundesliga and with the Champions League. I mean, a year from now, there will be no Champions League on Fox. It'll be on Turner Sports. So where does Warren Barton go? I mean, do you put him on the World Cup?
He has to fit into FIFA tournaments and Bundesliga. Otherwise, I don't know that they have a role for him.
Exactly. So what about the Man United-Leicester match, Kartik? Did you watch that one?
Yeah, I watched from kickoff of that match at 12:30, and it took a minute and 16 seconds. We've talked a lot about this on the show in the past, for Arlo White to introduce Lee Dixon and bring him in. Minute 16 into the match. I understand for some people they like that. Arlo White is painting a canvas. It's a game on NBC over the air, painting a canvas for the listeners out there and the viewers. Listeners, I say listeners because he's got a radio background, of course, of everything at stake in the match. But it's as if he gives you a full narrative about both clubs before he introduces his co-commentator. It's not my favorite style. I think it probably is the preferred style of a lot of our listeners. But to me, again, it's something I don't know if NBC he wants to encourage or discourage it, but I contrast it with the way John Champion brought us into the game at 7:30 and Eastern time, the Bournemouth-Manchester City game, where he brought David Pleat in right away. And there were large moments of where he just let the action breathe. And John Champion, as we discussed when we interviewed him here in Southern Florida when he was in town for the Clasico last month, has a radio background as well. So I guess it's just different styles.
I can't even picture what Arlo White would do if he had, say 10 or 20 seconds, just introduce the match or kick off the match and talk about that. It's so not his style that I have a hard job imagining what that would sound like, just because he is so talkative.
I mean, I just think about John Strong on Fox. And again, Portland Portland Seattle happened this weekend. Cascadia, and this is a Portland versus Seattle thing. Arlo White having been the voice of the Sounders, and John Strong having been the voice of the Timbers before they both moved on to bigger things. But John Strong brings in his co-commentator. Let's say he's working with Stu Holden. He will say, I think, just brief intro remarks, maybe 10 seconds, Chris. Mm-hmm. We'll have to watch this next time Strong does a game. But I think it's I generally think Strong goes for about 10 to 15 seconds. Then he brings in his co-commentator. So There's another Cascadia contrast coming the week after another Seattle-Portland game.
Yeah, definitely. So let me run through some of my matches, and then I'll hit it back to you, Kartik, if you have any other additional thoughts in terms of some of the other things you've been watching.
Sure.
I watched the Champions League draw. That was on FS2. Nothing much to say there. Watched Hajduk split against Everton. I also watched New York Red Bulls against NYCFC, and this was the game on the Friday night on ESPN. That you missed because of the hurricane, but I watched it. I missed the first half, so I only watched the second half. And Adrian Healy and Taylor Twellman commentating. And I must say that this is one of the most entertaining MLS games I've seen in quite a long time. I really enjoyed the second half. It was end-to-end action. There was one thing, though, that bothered me about this one, and that's what's the point of MLS having VAR if they're not going to use it? And there was an incident in the match. New York Red Bulls, they deserved a penalty. I think it was Bradley Wright Phillips got really knocked down in the box. I mean, really blatantly. The referee and the officiating crew and the VAR crew decided not to use the VAR. And right away, NYCFC countered and scored. So, I don't know, Kartik. I guess it's a mistake on MLS's part in terms of the officiating on this one. But you have the technology.
So here's what we get back to, and we talked about this a few weeks ago when I got a chance to sit down with Howard Webb. He wants to be judicious in how he uses it. He doesn't want to have constant stoppages. But perhaps then it's not as useful a tool, right? Because either you get the calls right or you just have a free-flowing game. Maybe the happy medium between those two doesn't work.
Yeah, the part of it I don't like is the subjectivity in terms of the crews deciding, how often to use it and how less often to use it. I mean, when it's something that's blatant, I guess in a derby it's going to be more heated and probably a little bit more physical. And there might be more incidents happening in a game that would be more controversial than, say, an average game. But if it's something so blatant that everyone sees it, I mean, Twellman said, that's definitely a penalty, wasn't called. And they have the technology, but they don't use it. And then they get hit on the counter, and then NYCFC scores. It's kind of like a double blow, really. So Kartik,
I found this kind of fascinating also, because we had the conversation a few weeks ago on the show about Howard Webb also saying it's at the referee, at the discretion of not the replay officials, like it is in Germany, or the what we're calling them, the VAR, right, the video assistant referee. It is at the discretion of the center referee. Mm-hmm. And clearly in this match, because I missed it because of Harvey, but I've gone back and seen everything because everybody's been talking about it for 6 days. So I'm fully aware of what happened. In this case, he decided just to play on. And yeah. Because NYCFC scored a goal, it just magnified everything. But as we were taught a couple of weeks ago when we sat with Howard Webb, once the next attacking move starts, play is over. So the next attacking move started. New York FC got possession. They scored on a counter. The discussion is over as far as the referee and the VAR and Major League Soccer are concerned. Now, in Germany, we've seen it applied very differently in these first couple of weeks of the Bundesliga. So watch this space. We're going to be having these conversations over and over again, I feel.
Yeah, Kartik, I think it's one of those things that sometimes counter attacks can happen so quickly that I realize the referee's probably only got a couple of seconds to make that call, to blow his whistle, to go to VAR. But if he's not seeing the incident, but we, the TV viewers, are and seeing how blatant it is, it puts the referee at a disadvantage, even more so now, because now there is an opportunity to use VAR. And if it's not being used, it makes it makes fans even more furious. So yeah. It's definitely one thing to watch as this technology unfolds. In terms of some of the other games I watched, I was away on Saturday. I think it was, like, I don't know, AYSO meetings or something like that. Some soccer season has started again for my kids. So I missed the Palace-Swansea game. I didn't watch it live. So when I came back that afternoon, I watched it on Premier League Pass. And again, it was there waiting for me. No spoilers, no advertising with NBC Gold. And I was able to go ahead and watch it. And what a game it was. I really loved watching that one, especially with Swansea getting the victory. Then I was able to go back in through the NBC Sports app, logging in with my Fubo TV authentication, with my login details through there, since I've cut the cord. And I was able to watch all of the highlights of the games on the Saturday morning that I missed. So got caught up really, really fast and enjoyed that. Watched Las Palmas against Atletico Madrid. Watched Chelsea Everton on the Sunday. West Brom against Stoke. I watched that one too. Actually, the Chelsea Everton match I was watching, and it got a bit bored by how horrible Everton was that day and how good Chelsea was. So I did switch it over to West Brom Stoke, and I watched about like the last 3 or 4 minutes of that game.
I have to say the Chelsea Everton series has turned on a dime since Everton's victory in the late Mourinho days at Goodison. These have been two of the most dominant performances between big clubs that I've seen in the Premier League era the last 2 years. The Chelsea-Everton games at the Bridge have been two of the most one-sided matches.
I laugh, Kartik, because actually in some ways this is probably works in NBC's favour in terms of if there is a match on a Sunday morning at 8:30 Eastern and it's Chelsea-Everton, and even if it's not the most competitive game, which this one wasn't, it was pretty one-sided. In the past, you could have then said, okay, well, let me go to NBC Sports Live Extra or the app or Premier League Extra Time, and let me switch over and let's watch West Brom against Stoke because that one might be a little bit more competitive. The way that the NBC Sports has got it set up now with Premier League Pass is it's going to prevent people from switching the channels, because if you don't have Premier League Pass, you're probably going to say, well, let me just stick with Chelsea against Everton and I'll watch the rest of that game. Or maybe you switch to Bundesliga. But in some ways, it actually works in NBC's favor. If somebody just wants to watch the Premier League, they might just stick with the game while in the past they wouldn't have done. And that improves NBC's numbers.
Yeah, I know the next game we're going to talk about, we have to have a conversation about Liverpool-Arsenal, because I'm sensing you probably feel the same way I do about the fact that half the pregame show was taken up on this discussion of Mignolet, when to me the most obvious thing is last season Arsenal had been opened up just so easily by Liverpool in both their meetings that's your logical starting point. And there ended up being the psychoanalysis, is he forcing Karius in? Is he unhappy with Mignolet? To the point where I don't think, and generally NBC studio talent is very good and they recovered at halftime and postgame, but I don't think they did the buildup for this matchup the proper justice and talked about what we were going to see. And what we saw was just a repeat performance of the last few times these two clubs have met, even at a magnified scale. This one was worse, but it was utterly predictable what happens when Liverpool under Klopp meets Arsenal under Wenger. Yet we didn't have the proper buildup and analysis coming into the match. And I thought that was, to me, a huge red blot on the weekend for NBC.
It was disappointing for sure, Kartik, because it was one of those things like pre-match, I think it was Carl Martino said that I just don't understand this. I just don't understand what he's doing, what he's thinking. Klopp, of course, in terms of benching Mignolet, well, not even starting him at all. As a soccer fan and as somebody that watches these games week in, week out, to me it made perfect sense, not just because of in previous matches, but in terms of just Mignolet. Even the game against Watford, there were a couple of goals there too that he could have done a better job at trying to save the balls coming at him. Yes, they were coming fast and furious, and the defense was to blame also. But to me, it made just perfect sense to give him an opportunity to bring Clarius in and sit out Mignolet. And I too, Kartik, was disappointed in terms of NBC's coverage of that particular incident, because it took up so much time. It took about probably like 10 or 15 minutes of coverage. And at the end of the game, I mean, that coverage was essentially meaningless.
We didn't talk about Arsenal setting up a team where they don't have a defensive midfielder in there. They don't have Coughlin in there. Elneny is injured. So they've started with Ramsey and Xhaka. It's utterly predictable what's going to happen with those two guys against the three-man midfield of Wijnaldum, Sean, and Henderson, right? It's obvious what was going to happen. There was no discussion of the fact that Oxlade-Chamberlain and Sanchez are both wannaways and were thrown into that lineup. And my opinions on Oxlade-Chamberlain's performance have been tweeted and retweeted on Twitter, right? So I don't want to get into that. And it's very ironic he ended up moving to Liverpool. But there wasn't the discussion of the things that were important in this match. And it's probably the first time in five seasons they've done it that I can say that about NBC leading into a big match. I was very disappointed.
Yeah, they all seem to be on the same track too. So maybe this is an opportunity where we're missing out on Robbie Musto, who could have maybe added some analysis here that would have been contrarian.
Yeah, Musto would have been all over that Arsenal lineup. Yeah.
So to me, it was kind of the good, the bad, and the ugly, because you had the good part of the analysis, which was a halftime from NBC, and especially Robbie Earle, who was able to pick out for the first goal that Liverpool scored, Firmino, that the Arsenal players, just seconds before that goal was scored, the Arsenal players, I think it was Ramsey was one of them, and there was another one, had their backs turned to the goal and was walking over to the sidelines to ask for instruction or talking to Wenger. And that was a really good point in terms of catching that and illustrating in terms of how the Arsenal players weren't focused. They were either looking for direction or receiving direction, but at the worst possible time. And also the halftime analysis from Carlo Martino in terms of just stripping away this first half Arsenal performance, just ripping it apart in terms of that. The bad would have been the pre-match in terms of just over-focusing on Mignolet. The ugly part of it, Kartik, for me at least, was post-match. And I thought that the analysis from the pundits was over the top. Yes, Arsenal was absolutely awful in this game. And they were, outfought, outplayed, outcoached, you name it. But it was interesting to me, and I thought it was over the top, that Lee Dixon said this was really the worst performance he's seen from an Arsenal team. And I was thinking to myself, is this really the worst performance? Is it any worse than Arsenal's 6-1? 8-2 or 6-1 defeat to Man United in 2001, the 8-2 game. I mean, Arsenal has had lots of horrible games. They've had lots of good games. But to say this is worse.
At 1-0, I was texting my Arsenal fan friends, telling them this looks worse than the 8-2. So, yeah. Because in that 8-2 game, if you remember, Manchester United scored a bunch of goals early. But there were large portions of the game where Arsenal were I thought played decently. This game, even at 1-0, it just looked like there were guys who weren't trying. I've used the term sabotage with Ox. Maybe that was a too strong a word, but he certainly, the second goal, you watch back the second goal. I challenge anyone to watch the Mane goal and watch Oxlade-Chamberlain as the right wing back. And first, the way he jogs, lightly jogs, and then the angle he takes, leaving poor Rob Holding on an island against one of the top 5 or 10 players in the Premier League. There's only going to be one winner in that. Mm-hmm. But there was this, I think there was a serious lack of effort from the Arsenal players. In that 8-2 game, I think we were at a point that year when Arsenal had a ton of injuries and entered the 2011-2012 season, if folks remember the context, with half the team injured and with transfer rumors swirling. Now, the transfer rumors swirling also applied to this one. But, yeah, it took them, Chris, about 15 minutes to start discussing Liverpool and how well they had played, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. And then they kept on apologizing for it. I think Rebecca Lowe said, I know you Liverpool fans are probably furious about this, but that's let's focus on Arsenal first. It was poor, and it seems to be at least. I mean, Lee Dixon in his part was over the top, in my opinion. They were over the top about the praise for Man United, but the reality is that actually the TV numbers, which we'll get into later, have been really, really, really good. So maybe this is what the audience wants, is over the top analysis. But to me, it's just disappointing a little bit in terms of what we've seen.
It's also relative to expectations, because I'll get to ESPN FC maybe in a bit, but and the week they've had with the transfer deadline day. But on Arsenal, I've been talking for weeks about how ESPN FC has been hypercritical of Arsenal. No one picked them in their top four. They're down on Wenger. They're high on Tottenham, unlike NBC. And this, the analysis of this game in the ESPN FC studio was basically, yeah, this is what we expected. Yeah, this is it. This is the same mistake he always makes. And it wasn't over the top. It wasn't excited because it is the level of performance from Arsenal in these sorts of games that Moreno, Nickel, Hislop, and Burley expect. So maybe part of it was NBC, again, as we talked, I've talked about on the show for 3 weeks now, has overhyped Arsenal this season, thinking that they're, and maybe that's again to drive numbers. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, that could be a strategy to kind of hype them up, and then once we know that they're going to fall, is just hit them hard it makes for interesting television, but I don't know. We'll have to wait and see.
Although Rebecca Lowe, to her credit, I think finally said, haven't we been having the same conversation for five years? Because this goes back to, on this podcast, the previous iteration, Richard Farley and I got a lot of critique from Arsenal fans. Remember this, Chris? Mm-hmm. Who would say, how come you say if this team signs this player, West Brom signs this player, Stoke signs that player, things are different and they could be better, but Arsenal, you're saying it's always the same? Because it is always the same. Mm-hmm. And we would get so much stick, but Richard and I would say, hey, until Wenger shows us something different, we're just going to stick with our analysis from 2011 and 2012 and apply it to Arsenal and for the other 19 teams in the Premier League come up with original thoughts. Wow. And that's where we're at.
Yeah, still. Yeah. Not a lot has changed since then.
Richard and I had got a lot of complaints from those of you listening out there. Mm-hmm.
So one more match I watched, context I do want to mention, that was Real Madrid against Valencia. That was on the Sunday match. And this one, to me, was the game of the weekend. A really entertaining 2-2 tie. Ronaldo, of course, not playing due to suspension. But probably Ray Hudson probably summed this game up the best. He had a quote towards the end of the match. And his quote during the commentary was, there's more bodies on the ground than the Godfather. And it was a very physical game, lots of fouls. Again, almost like Bournemouth City with players going down. And it was just a really entertaining game to watch. And I thoroughly enjoyed that one. So, Kartik,
two other quick things. I don't know why I didn't have them in the notes. I thought I'd put them in. Roma Inter, I was able to watch that on BeIN Sports en Español. I thought it was a fantastically cagey tactical match. Spalletti at his best against his former side.
That's one thing, Kartik, is that this season, more than any other season, is that in terms of Serie A coverage on BeIN Sports, there's less and less on the English side. So there's usually now about one game on a Saturday, which is usually the Juve game that you'll find on the English Sports, and maybe one on the Sunday. But it's really now, especially with La Liga having this staggered schedule where there's no games overlapping. It's one after the next, after the next, after the next. Almost all of those are on BeIN Sports, other than PSG games, which even the PSG games, when they do kind of match up at the same time with the Spanish league, usually they'll move the PSG game then to connect. But as a whole, in terms of Serie A coverage, I think for most fans, it's a bit disappointing. I mean, you can get it through Connect, but it's not the same.
Seattle-Portland final game of the weekend I watched was something I'm always very excited about. John Strong versus Arlo White, in a way, as we talked about earlier, from a broadcasting perspective. This wasn't the best Cascadia match by a long shot. They're first and second in the Western Conference. I sense neither team really wanted to go for it in the second half. So this is a byproduct of not wanting to lose to your rival and being in prime pole position, whatever you want to call it, for the playoffs. And the game kind of being cagier and less exciting than I had hoped. And I'm a big fan of these matchups. So I was disappointed. FS1 did a good job covering it, by the way. But I was disappointed by the match.
All right, Kartik, let's move on to TV streaming news.
Yeah, so most of you are probably aware of this if you're podcast listeners. And a lot of you have written to me or tweeted me, DM'd me about James Richardson leaving The Guardian's Football Weekly. James Richardson and producer Ben have moved on. They've teamed up with Ian McIntosh to start a new pod on Ian McIntosh's new pod network. And Max Rushton is the new host. But it's the same kind of team of cast of characters around him. For example, on Monday we had Barry Glendening and Jonathan Wilson in the pod with Rushton, and that of course leads to heavy Sunderland discussions and Sunderland analogies about everything when you have those two. But it's the same pod, except maybe the style of the presenter is different. So I don't think this is the apocalyptic event so many of you have made it out to be. Give Max Rushton a chance. His style's different. But I'm still listening to Football Weekly. I don't have a problem with it.
In other news, Premier League Pass has made some much-needed upgrades. What they've done, first of all, is they've added the on-demand functionality. So if you do subscribe to Premier League Pass via NBC Sports Gold, is that now you can actually you don't have to watch Premier League news and Fan Zone and Premier League Today and all those other shows that they have as far as the shoulder programming. Previously, they were only available live, but now you can watch them live or on demand. So that makes a big difference. And the Premier League news show is particularly really, really good, featuring interviews with their talent from around the UK in terms of at the stadiums. I would highly recommend that. That's definitely a plus on the Premier League Pass. Also, we reported this week on worldsoccertalk.com is that NBC Sports is in talks with cable companies to figure out a solution for Premier League Pass for bars and pubs and restaurants that do want to show those games. As of right now, NBC says it's okay with people, you know, bar owners, subscribing to Premier League Pass and then showing those games in bars. But that is up until they can find a solution that they can sell then to bars, which usually costs a lot more. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see if they come up with a solution. They mentioned cable. Hopefully it's cable and satellite, because there's not a lot of bars that have exclusively cable. Most of them have DirecTV. But still, some good news there from Premier League Pass and NBC. Kartik, on to other news.
Yeah, play up Pompey. A lot of excitement among the Portsmouth fans here in the United States. ESPN3 will be streaming select League One matches this week during the international break. It includes a Portsmouth match. Also, you'll get to see Bradford City, Peterborough United, and some other League One clubs. So exciting news, especially if you want to kind of broaden your horizons with football during the international break.
Okay, Kartik, let's move on to TV ratings. And some big news this past week in terms of some interesting numbers coming out of the different leagues on U.S. television. How about you kick it off in terms of some of the findings we see?
Yeah, so 2 million plus games in the Premier League this weekend. And we talked about last season how the struggles for NBC in most cases to cross that million plateau. They did it with two matches this weekend. This is obviously Spanish and English language numbers. We've combined them for you. 1,083,000 on Man United Leicester, which was NBC and Universo. So one over the air, one cable. And just about 10,000 fewer viewers on average for Liverpool Arsenal Sunday morning on NBCSN and Telemundo. So again, that's a cable channel in English and over the air in Spanish. Those are fantastic numbers, and actually beat the top Liga MX games this weekend, which were Tigres Lobos on Univision on Saturday night. That was 860,000 viewers, and 809,000 for the Chivas match against Cuartero on Univision on Saturday night. Liga MX's on average does have a game or two that outdraws a Premier League game every weekend. That did not happen this weekend.
Yeah, the Bundesliga now too, Kartik. This is really impressive because we've had quite a few years now of sub 100K viewers for the big matches, other than the ones that are on, of course, over the air Fox. But this is the second week in a row that we've had some 100K plus viewing figures.
So this is going to be worrying for MLS fans, because MLS people will always, that their retort is, well, look at the numbers the Bundesliga gets. We're getting two, three, four times that. Now that gap, if we look at just a couple of isolated games this week, the MLS games did have better numbers, but not by much. Continue.
Yeah, so part of it, there's a few different reasons why they're improving. One is this, that the games are being shown on Univision Deportes, or at least some select games are being shown on Univision Deportes. That's one reason. The second reason, of course, is Christian Pulisic. But so looking at the numbers, we had 162,000 for Bremen against Bayern Munich. That was on FS1 and Univision Deportes Network combined. 156,000 for Dortmund against Hertha Berlin. That was on FS1 and Fox Deportes combined. So those are some big numbers for the Bundesliga and actually very promising. And we'll get to MLS in a little bit. There were some lower numbers, though, too, from the German leagues. We had, well, one example, actually, a bad example, Kartik, is Leverkusen losing Chicharito, but Leverkusen against Hoffenheim, that was on FS2, and that had 6,000 viewers. So, I mean, that's partly FS2, again, kind of the last bastion of soccer coverage. But you had Cologne against Hamburg. That was on the Friday game. And that just had 40,000.
The Leipzig-Freiburg game had over 100,000 viewers. That's really surprising. I don't know if that's a one-off, but you have two. Leipzig obviously finished second in the league last year, but they don't have a following in the U.S. And Freiburg hardly has a following in Germany outside of their town.
And that must have been a Sunday game. So that's,
yes, that was a Sunday
game. That's interesting in terms of definitely picking up numbers on the Sunday games too, which usually those wouldn't do that well, just because there's, you know,
what you said, the Premier League pass isn't available. So if there were people who wanted to watch Spurs and Burnley when they saw how bad Arsenal were, maybe they switched to the Bundesliga game instead, because they didn't have that option.
Or it could be new sports fans or new viewers into this. So some promising numbers definitely from Bundesliga. Yeah. Now looking at Major League Soccer, Kartik, it was one of those weeks that I was really disappointed with the numbers, again, unfortunately. But, I mean, with it being MLS rivalry week, I mean, it's hyped up a lot. So you had some of the numbers that came out, for example, you had 181,000 for Montreal against Toronto. That was on ESPN on Sunday. I think it was like at 4 o'clock or 4:30. LA Galaxy against San Jose.
This is the one that stands out to me as being really disappointing.
Yeah.
These are two California teams. We've seen huge numbers for this matchup when it's been on Univision. Huge by MLS standards.
Well, over a million.
Yeah. Actually still huge, even by Premier League and Liga MX standards. This is a stunner to me. Just an absolute shock how low that number was.
Yes, 191,000 people watching this one on Fox Sports 1.
Now, granted, the Galaxy's play are not giving many people incentive to watch them. But again, that goes back, I think, to my point about Los Angeles and big market teams in MLS, that if they're not really good, their fan base is very fickle. And actually, in the case of the Galaxy, I don't think they really have a fan base beyond people who go to the games. I've been saying that for years, that you cannot build a television product just because you're in big markets based on those sorts of teams. You're better off hitching your wagon to Atlanta, Seattle, Portland, Orlando.
Yeah, in some ways, though, I understand the local aspect. I mean, I'm looking at it from a national aspect, but why aren't fans tuning in to watch one of the biggest games of the season for LA Galaxy? And I think, I don't know, we can do a whole separate podcast on this. And actually, we've got some feedback in the listener mailbag. We can probably talk about it more there. But there's lots of reasons. There's not just one or two. There's lots of reasons why these numbers are low. Continuing on, so we had New York Red Bulls against NYCFC. This was the Friday night game, live on ESPN, primetime. And that one had 228,000 viewers. And then the Seattle-Portland game that you mentioned before, that one was on FS1 and Fox Deportes combined for 342,000. So just as one example, Kartik, Goal Zone, the Premier League highlight show on NBCSN on Sunday, had more viewers than the Seattle-Portland game, which was the most watched MLS game from the weekend. And if you take all of the MLS games combined, all four of those, combine them into one, that number is still less than the Liverpool Arsenal and Man United against Leicester games that were on NBC.
Yeah, I think MLS has a horrible TV product problem. And again, I will point this out for about the 100th time in the last 5 years, Seattle and Portland draw better numbers than New York teams or Los Angeles teams. Full stop.
Yeah, absolutely.
Proven once again. I don't know why I continue to have this debate with people who are MLS proponents about the Galaxy and about Red Bull and about NYCFC. There are those two teams, now Atlanta and Orlando. Those are what you hitch your wagon to. I don't care that they're in smaller markets. Atlanta's actually not a smaller market. I don't care that the other three are in smaller markets. MLS has got to start thinking that way, and I think they kind of are. I think we're seeing a bit of a change, but we'll get to more of this in the listener mailbag. I know we've got a question about it.
One more thing, Kartik, and I do want to highlight this, is PSG. So for the first time in my memory, I don't remember this ever happening, but a Ligue 1 game got more than 100,000 viewers. And this was for the PSG against Saint Etienne game, 110,000 viewers. This game was on beIN Sports and beIN Sports en Espanol. Obviously, the Neymar effect having a big factor in this one, but for Ligue 1 in the US, that's a huge number and a huge kind of watermark for them to hit.
I think as awareness continues to grow as to when PSG is on beIN, those numbers will grow.
And like I said too last week, Kartik, on the last week's pod, the highlights show I saw from Ligue 1 just blew me away. I was like, wow, you mean, this is a league I want to watch more of. And of course, it's hard to fit everything in, but from what I've seen from Ligue 1 this season, it's been really entertaining. So let's move on to listener mailbag. We've got a few emails and tweets and Facebook messages. The first one is from Alan Huffman, and he sent this in through email. He says, last weekend, I tried using NBC Sports Gold and the Premier League Pass for the first time to watch the Spurs-Burnley match, and I had major issues attempting to use the service. I didn't get to watch the majority of the game because the video kept shutting off and giving me a error message that said, this content is not available. This happened because it kept logging me out of the site, and I was constantly having to log back in with my credentials. Once I logged back in, I would bring up the game for about 1 to 2 minutes, but then the feed would be constantly rewinding and fast-forwarding like a TV until it caught up to the live stream. Then about three to four minutes later, I would get the error message and have to start all over again. Now, during the time the game was playing, the audio seemed to be about 5 to 10 seconds behind the video, and then the video quality was all over the place, ranging from very good to completely blurry, where it was difficult to even see the players. I contacted NBC support to ask what was happening and if it was a problem on my end or their end, and never got a response. So he says, do you think if other people are having similar issues? Based off my experience today, I was very disappointed with the pass and the lack of help from NBC customer support. I was on the fence about getting the pass and decided I would at least give it a shot, but I'm regretting that decision now. I love the pod. Thanks for all the work you guys put into it. So, Alan, I will answer you and say that you weren't the only one. There was a lot of people that had issues with the Spurs-Burnley game, especially. And there were Spurs supporters groups throughout the U.S. who were complaining vociferously, really, really loudly in terms of beIN pissed off. I mean, going into bars, their local supporters club bar to watch the game, having it streamed on the TV sets through Premier League Pass, and it wasn't working. Now, I don't know how much of that issues stem from Wi-Fi or kind of a strong internet signal, but for so many people to have issues and complaints with this one, it's definitely a bad look for NBC Sports. And this is a story I wrote about over a week ago, and I said to them that their first big test would be the Spurs-Burnley game, not only because there would be a lot more people interested in it, but also this is one of those games that would people go to illegal streaming, which in some ways is easier to find than the Premier League Pass. So far, so good for the Premier League Pass up till the Spurs-Burnley game, but definitely a bad look from this one.
Yeah, and Chris, you not to toot our horn here at the site, but you were talking about that all week last week, that this was really the first test. Yes, we've had 2 weeks of the season, but this is the first time a big club with a big and perhaps the most vocal U.S.-based fan base with Spurs is beIN dropped a Premier League pass. This is the big test. Well, yeah. Unfortunately, it didn't work out for some folks.
Yeah, and somebody tweeted, I can't remember who it was, but imagine what would happen if that was Man United. which is going to happen. I mean, there's going to be a Man United game.
Yeah, although
on
I don't know. I think Spurs, well, they're more Man United fans, but I think Spurs probably have the most ruckus, active fan base in this country of Premier League clubs.
That's debatable.
They're the most vocal ones. But they may have a quarter of the fans Man United has, so it would affect more people. But Spurs fans tend to be loud about everything.
Okay. So the next,
at least in this country, I'm not saying in abroad, but here they are.
Okay.
Where I sit.
Okay. So next up is Raymond Orozco through Facebook, and he says, "I like your guys' podcast. I think it's really informative and entertaining. I listen to a lot of soccer podcasts, and I watch a lot of soccer, and I think the best game of the weekend was Madrid against Valencia. And yet, for whatever reason, the English language soccer podcasts don't go in depth. Like, it was the Liverpool versus Arsenal, and the game was boring." Anyway, he goes on to say that there's so many entertaining games, more entertaining games in Spain that don't get the coverage that the EPL does in English, because in Spanish television and podcast, there's more talking points than the Liverpool-Arsenal game. So I agree. I mean, in many ways, a lot of it is accessibility. I mean, it's a lot more accessible to be able to watch Liverpool against Arsenal, whether it's through Telemundo, which was, over the air, or if it's through NBCSN versus beIN Sports and beIN Sports and Espanol. Yes, beIN Sports, you can get it if you really, really want it. But I watched the game, and to me, it was my favorite for the weekend. So there you go, Raymond. All right, next up is... this is actually from Mike from Salt Lake City, Utah. He sent it in through email. He says, "I enjoyed the podcast last week. Interesting topic. I think MLS has tried to bump up its ratings in a couple of different ways, such as featuring the LA Galaxy almost every week. MLS has also tried featuring more teams and consistent TV times for national television. Neither has seemed to result in a ratings increase. I support Real Salt Lake and make sure I catch the match every week. But honestly, I wouldn't seek out a Toronto against Montreal game on ESPN. My question is, do you guys think that while people support their local clubs, there just isn't interest in other MLS games on TV? And why do you think people will adjust the TV viewing for La Liga or EPL, but not for MLS? Thanks for answering my questions."
Yeah, I've talked a lot about this in the past. My experience with fans, San Jose fans, Orlando fans, a lot of Houston and Dallas fans are that they watch their league. They watch their clubs. They love their clubs, but they don't watch the rest of the league. And they actually, in the case of a lot of Orlando fans, look down upon the rest of the league, saying, MLS is garbage. You know, we have to do this. We have to be in MLS, move up from USL because it's the top league here. But I'm gonna spend that time watching the Bundesliga or the Premier League. So I think that there is a general feeling that the league itself is not that compelling. It's not that interesting to other fans. The results of other games don't matter as much as they do if you're a general fan of, let's say you're an Arsenal fan and you need to see the Spurs results because you're always fighting for fourth and fifth. Not anymore. Now Spurs are better than that. But for years, that was the case, right? Perennially, they were head-to-head, not just local rivals, but head-to-head for fourth and fifth. There just isn't that relevance in MLS. And I have gone on for years and had these just kind of nasty arguments with people associated with Major League Soccer about the use of the Galaxy and the use of the New York teams to try and prop ratings up rather than Seattle and Portland and now Atlanta and Orlando. And I feel like I'm winning that battle. But you want to watch something that's going to be compelling to you, right? You want to watch something that's going to captivate you and capture you. When you watch a Premier League game, there is some ambiance from the ground. There's some level of entertainment. There's an expectation that you're going to be part of, you're going to be watching theater. That's not the case with most MLS games. Now, when games are in Portland and they're in Seattle, particularly in Portland, and now when they're in Orlando in the new stadium and in Atlanta, it's different. It's not like watching a game from the Home Depot Center or watching a game from Red Bull or watching a game from Philly, right? It has some of those aspects that attract us to European football beyond the match itself. So that is what MLS has to do. I mean, they should just keep showing those four teams, honestly. That's what I would do, because it is about ambiance. It is about atmosphere. It is about feeling like it's theater and it's a big event. You don't get that when you watch the LA Galaxy at the StubHub Center. I'm sorry. You just don't.
one more thing, Kartik. It's about meaning. It's about meaningful games.
Yeah, right. And they can't do, right? Like I explained earlier, they're not going to be able to do that unless they change their format.
Well, the format of the way that the league is set up. But just one example, correct. The Newcastle against West Ham game from Saturday, that had more viewers than any of the MLS games. And why did that have more viewers? And to me, it's because that game's more meaningful. We're only three games into the season, but both Newcastle and West Ham, before going into that match, were fearful of relegation. They're fearful that, okay, what's going to happen to my season? You mean, this is a must-win game. Why is it a must-win game? Because if you finish the bottom three, you'll go down. So to me, it's versus, say, watching, I don't know, Philadelphia Union. I mean, what meaning is in those games to watch it? If it's not your local team, why would you, if you live in Texas or Florida or California, why would you watch the Philadelphia Union?
Let me give you a great example. I went to an Orlando City game with a bunch of the Ruckus members last season when they were still playing at the Citrus Bowl. Came back to hang out with them, and there was another MLS game on ESPN at that time. It was a Sunday. And they were like, no, let's see if we can fire up. At the time, we didn't have Premier League Gold. We had Live Extra, right?
Right.
Let's just fire up the computer and hook it up to the monitor. We'll watch one of the Premier League games we missed from earlier today. That was the and they did that.
Wow. It's not even live. Right,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, we sat and watched the tape delayed Premier League game because, and I was the one lobbying to turn on the Kansas City game, and they were like, no, why would we want to watch it? Why would we care? They're in the Western Conference; they don't matter. Mm-hmm. And we missed. I think it was Stoke, and it was Stoke in a big team. It might have been Stoke Man United or Stoke Liverpool. We missed that game. Let's watch it. Mm-hmm. It was incredible.
Yeah. And then the last question, feedback from one of the listeners, it's Ian O'Neill from Lancaster, Pennsylvania. He sent this in through email. He says, should MLS just start over and copy the Liga MX and Copa MX structure, i.e. have two simultaneous competitions per season occurring biannually with a Champions Trophy and a Super Cup played between both of those seasons? What do you think, Kartik?
Yeah, I think it's maintained. It's very confusing in the NASL. They do something similar. It's confusing, and I don't think they quite have had the communication strategy that's been robust enough to explain it to fans, and fans still get confused, and they're very Americanized. But if it were done at the MLS level, I think core football fans would adapt it and understand it. It's done in many places in Latin America, not just in Liga MX, but places like Argentina, et cetera, where you have that sort of format. And another thing I would encourage is to have state tournaments like you have in Brazil. We could have a massive one in Florida. We've got 12 teams in the first round of U.S. Open Cup. That doesn't include our professional teams. And have that in between the seasons. But there are reasons MLS doesn't want to do this. One of the reasons is their collective bargaining agreement, believe it or not, which limits when the players can train and when they can play, unless they're loaned out to a European or Liga MX club. So there are obstacles, unfortunately, just these immovable obstacles when you talk about progressive ideas like the one you've suggested, Ian.
And we did a podcast. It was the June 2nd podcast. It was called What MLS Can Learn from Liga MX or Liga MX. And so we went into more detail on that one. If you guys want to go ahead and go back into the archives and listen to that. If you do have any questions, feedback, or comments for anything we say in the show, or anything above and beyond that in terms of soccer TV coverage or soccer streaming coverage, you can hit us up through email, which is web@worldsoccertalk.com. Twitter is @WSoccerTalk, and then Facebook is facebook.com/WorldSoccerTalk. Now, moving on, Kartik, to our feature topic of the week, and that is it actually results from a question from one of our listeners, which is Holden Cribb, and he sent this in through Twitter, and he says, what are your thoughts on how far away we are from having a true a la carte soccer package? For example, to pay for just ESPN 1 and 2, beIN Sports, FS1, FS2, Unimas, etc. I just switched from Fubo to Sling, and I'm still paying $35 a month with tons of channels I don't care to watch, or I don't care for. So it's a great question, because like, what is the future of streaming, especially when it comes to soccer coverage? And I think in many ways, the way that it's set up right now, you have a bunch of different streaming services. There isn't just the one service that has everything. So you have aggregators, which are essentially glorified cable companies, such as Sling TV, PlayStation View, and DirecTV Now. So they're talking about cut the cord and have a la carte programming. But essentially, Sling, PlayStation, and DirecTV Now are really cable companies. They've got all most of your cable channels, and it seems to be kind of just a new form of aggregating all those cable companies onto a streaming package. Then you have more specialized streaming services such as FuboTV, which is focused on sports, but also has a healthy dose of entertainment, kids, and news channels on top of that. But it also has Chelsea TV and has some of the Portuguese leagues and other leagues and content that you wouldn't be able to find elsewhere. Then you have direct-to-consumer streaming services that come from clubs or leagues, such as iFollow, for fans of football league clubs in England. And then you've got Rangers TV, Celtic TV, a lot of the Scottish teams, in addition to the football league teams, streaming directly to you, the consumer. So if you wanted to watch, I don't know, Bradford City matches, you could subscribe to Bradford City's streaming channel and get all of those delivered to you. So what you have is really, and actually in addition to that, then you have in-between services such as Premier League Pass, which is kind of an add-on service to what's already out there. So that's where we are today. And then next season then too, you've got the streaming product that's going to be coming out from Turner Sports, which we've talked about in previous episodes, which will give you access to all of the Europa League games exclusively. That's the only way you can get those games other than the final. And then about 50% of the Champions League games, and that's going to be its own product. We don't know much about we don't know anything yet about the name or what other sports programming it'll offer, what the price will be. And then you've got ESPN, they'll be coming out with a service which will, it sounds like it'll be a lot like ESPN3 in terms of combining a lot of sports programming, boxing, soccer, MLS, etc., into one package to subscribe to that. So where is everything heading? Because to me, in some ways, the one advantage of having kind of the old system of, if you're a Comcast or DirecTV or Dish or whatever your cable subscriber system is that it was less confusing because you'd subscribe to Comcast or DirecTV or whoever, and you'd get an all-in-one system that gave you pretty much all the games that you wanted from the teams and leagues that you're interested in. And you didn't have to think about it. Now, the streaming side of things has made things more complicated. So depending on if you're a fan of, say, maybe support Rangers, and you also like watching the Premier League, and you love watching La Liga, and you're into MLS too, you might have to have like two or three different streaming packages just to be able to have access to all the games and all the leagues that you're interested in. And at the end of the day, it's probably going to cost you more than what you were paying for before. So it does make it more complicated. It is seems to be that heading that way. It seems to be that that's the way we're heading, is that we're going to end up paying more for maybe more niche programming. What do you think, Kartik? Is this the way that you see things are heading, or do you see them heading in a different way?
I absolutely see them headed in this direction. I think we're going to be paying more for niche programming. We're already seeing that with Premier League Pass, with whatever Turner offers next season as their sort of way of exposing us to Europa League, etc. I think we're also looking at a situation where rights fees have accelerated so high for other leagues and other sports that maybe a lot of soccer fans are not aware of. And for years, ESPN has just thrown its excess content they get from those contracts. I'll take the SEC and ACC contracts as an example in college sports. They've just thrown that stuff on ESPN3 and offered it essentially for free if you have ESPN. Now, of course, if you get into the nitty-gritty of how cable bills are formulated, you're paying a lot more for ESPN than you are for NBCSN. You're paying a lot more for ESPN than you are for any channel. But, essentially for free, at least from where they sit. I think they're going to start packaging that stuff into specialized niche packages. You can get the other six SEC games for this amount each weekend on this with this SEC may be a bad example because those games tend to be on television, but the other six, whatever, from whichever conference, whichever league, and you might have a la carte packages. Now, if you're a fan of all these things, you're going to end up paying more than you've ever paid for your cable bill or satellite bill. To where cord cutting, which was initially a way of saving money, ends up the net effect of it ends up streaming everything ends up costing a lot more money.
Yeah,
I think we might be there. Well, we might get there, I should say.
Right. Yeah. In some ways, it does give you the kind of the freedom to go ahead and do what you want to do. So if you do cut the cord, most of the contracts are on a month-to-month basis. So as the industry changes, as more and more television coverage moves to streaming, some of it moving to streaming exclusively, such as the Europa League for next season, is that at least you have the freedom to go ahead and choose whether to subscribe to that or not. So for you as a listener, or for me myself as a cord cutter, I can pick and choose the things that I'm interested in and pay that amount of money for it. Will I be happy with that? I think it depends on the quality of the streaming coverage, to making sure that it works and is high quality, but also kind of just what choices are available, because I might be happier, well, maybe not happier, but I might be okay with just paying what I was paying before for cable, but actually having more control over what I'm watching.
Can I ask you now, as a cord cutter, the expectation around the quality of streams you get? What's your level of expectation? Are you expecting it to replicate your cable experience, or are you expecting a drop off?
Yeah, I'm expecting it to hit the same as cable, which is kind of a high bar to.
Yeah.
But I have fiber, so I have AT&T fiber as far as my internet connection, so there should be no reason why there should be buffering. So I've been testing. DirecTV Now is one example. I've been testing that for the last 3 or 4 weeks to see if that would be something that I might be interested in subscribing to, and I've had buffering issues with that. So that, to me, and actually watching the same coverage then with Fubo or Sling and having no buffering issues. So that's a DirecTV Now issue that they need to resolve. But that's the bar I'm looking at, is having that flawless experience. Yes. Now and again, things are not going to be perfect. Maybe I have to hit refresh or exit out of the app and go back in to watch it. But it should be, we're getting there. We're getting closer and closer to having it as easy as switching on cable. I mean, it does open up more opportunities. It does open up more choices. And I think it's one of those things that we still don't know. I mean, in many ways, as far as BAMTech and Turner, what price points they're going to be offering this content at. So if BAMTech comes back next year and comes with a kind of a soccer package that has the Championship, League One, League Two in England, as well as some other rights, maybe FA Cup or something like that. What is
MLS
that?
MLS maybe.
Well, ESPN's going to have their separate one, which is going to be through BAMTech too. So maybe it'll be joined together. Who knows? But it's going to be separate. Same thing with Turner too, in terms of what's Turner going to charge for this coverage of Europa League and Champions League. Now, I mean, that could have a big factor. And I think in many ways is that BAMTech is the one that could be the best or worst thing that happens to soccer streaming coverage in the U.S., most of it's depending on the pricing, in terms of kind of what they view that price point is that soccer fans would be open to paying that. But we'll have to wait and see, because we don't know in terms of what they're going to be charging for a lot of these services in the future. But Turner Sports too. Turner Sports could kill the Europa League in terms of the popularity. Well, it's not a huge popular league, but it's been growing in popularity. And they could kill the Europa League in terms of if they price it out of the market. But then again, they could maybe give a big boost to the Europa League by offering it, say, for less than Fox Soccer To Go did. I guess there's a lot of unknown questions. I think you're right, Kartik, in terms of the way things are heading, where it is going to be more complicated. We're going to have to kind of see our way through this kind of sea of streaming services. And I think everyone's kind of jumping on the bandwagon too. Like, they're all kind of thinking about what service can we offer? Can we charge this? I think a lot of the the industry too is looking at iFollow, looking at the direct-to-consumer model. So football clubs and football leagues from around the world are probably saying, okay, if iFollow is a success, then why can't we do the same thing for, I mean, their Divisi or some of these other clubs? And we've seen that too. Chivas. Chivas has a direct-to-consumer streaming platform, Chivas TV, that's actually run by NBC Sports, the digital group, but is only available outside of the United States. So I think the football leagues are looking at this as iFollows and the Rangers TV and the Celtic TVs. So that could change things too. But that's the thing. It is change. And at the end of the day, I think it's as consumers, at least this is on a month-to-month contract, so if things do change, we can cancel the subscriptions pretty easily and then move from one platform to another, because I'm sure there's going to be a lot of consolidation too in the future in terms of, you mean, companies gobbling up other ones or services changing, such as we've seen with PlayStation View dropping beIN Sports completely from the lineup, just as one example.
Yeah. I think that this is a never born topic, and it's going to continue to evolve in the next year or two. For a long time, there have been people who've wanted a la carte cable services, and that never happened, right? You had tier one, tier two, tier three, tier four. This, in a way, as you said, gives you more flexibility, gives you a way of kind of controlling your own destiny and picking what you want if it goes the direction we think it's going to go. So a lot here. Thank you once again for the question. And I think it really has opened up an interesting discussion here. So Holden, that was a fantastic thing. It's not very often we get a question that we decide we need to spend 15 minutes on discussing, but that was fantastic.
Exactly. All right, Kartik, so this is a wrap up. And so where can listeners find you on the internet if they want to see your work?
KKFLA737. You can find me on Twitter. Look for me on Facebook, Google Plus as well. You could check me out at World Soccer Talk, thefloridasqueeze.com, and prostamerica.com.
All right. Well, thanks for listening. You can get a new episode of the World Soccer Talk podcast every Thursday. Every episode is released on SoundCloud, YouTube, Stitcher, iTunes, Audio Boom, Spreaker, and worldsoccertalk.com. If you like the show, share it with your friends on social media, and be sure to give us a review on iTunes. And Kartik, with the international break upon us, what should they do?
Try and enjoy your football, folks, but I know it's tough. We're a week away from meaningful club action again.